Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
You're listening to All of It. I'm Allison Stewart. Throughout the show, we're bringing you suggestions for some great art shows around the city. Next up is a rebroadcast of a conversation about a retrospective of the work of Charles White, currently at MoMA. The 1979 New York Times obituary of White quotes Benny Andrews, a New York painter and archivist who said, quote, "People who don't know his name knew and recognized his work." White was an innovative artist who, over a 40-year career, captured African-American subjects from Harriet Tubman and Bessie Smith to anonymous figures like one of his most famous, Black Pope. He was a master of life drawings and inspired cultural figures like Harry Belafonte and Emery Douglas, the Black Panther's Minister of Culture. He was also a beloved teacher and mentor to aspiring African-American artists. Now the Museum of Modern Art and the Art Institute of Chicago are presenting the first major museum retrospective of Charles White's work in over 30 years. It will be on display at MoMA through January 13th. We spoke to Esther Adler, curator at MoMA, and Ian White, the son of Charles White, earlier this fall. I began by asking Esther Adler why it is that so many people don't know Charles White's name but recognize his work.
I think Charles White was an amazing artist, and I think the images in many ways say it all. It was important to him to get them out there and to have them communicate directly with viewers, kind of regardless of what you knew about art, who you were, what walk of life you came from. So I think for him, the work always came first.
So go ahead, Ian.
Oh, and it also spoke to, they were utilizing his image to document Black life. And when there was no photographic representation of this, at times, horrific events that were occurring, it was Charles White's image that you would see in publications.
So for folks who are driving, can't do this, but I'm going to tell people at home, if you're near a device, to go Google right now, Charles White, so they can see some of the images, and then you will say, I know that work.
Absolutely.
But for folks who are driving and can't do that, Esther, would you please describe the genre of work and the style of it for folks?
Sure. So Charles White was unabashedly dedicated to figurative and mostly representational artwork. His style changes over time. He begins with maybe a more expressionistic, kind of angular style that becomes rounder, more realistic, I guess, over time, but he always created the figure, and it was, for the most part, the African-American figure.
Now, when did you realize your dad was this incredible artist?
Very young, actually. Mm-hmm. I was able to travel with him, and then you would have these kind of relationships with people, like a driver, and when they would find out that, this is Charles White I'm driving, and, you know, that may have been their job initially, but then they would volunteer to drive him around whatever town we were in. It was very kind of a personal relationship they felt they had with him because they were familiar with the images.
And when was the first time you saw his work displayed in a professional setting? Do you remember?
No, actually I don't, because you kind of, they're interwoven.
All the memories together.
In terms of, you know, you find yourself through these museums and galleries. It's like I have an 8-year-old that I am taking to all these events. Mm-hmm. And he has a moment in time, but it doesn't really click in until you ask questions like, was the whole museum dedicated to Grandpa Charles?
You made an interesting point. You talked about him being driven around by a driver. And Esther, during his lifetime, he did have some acclaim. It sort of fell off after his death. Can you talk about that arc?
Sure. I mean, for me, in going back and doing the research, it became very clear that Charles White was certainly one of the best-known African-American artists of his time. If you look at figures today like Romare Bearden, Jacob Lawrence, who are so well-known for their work, he was certainly at that level during his lifetime. I think because he dies quite young and because he's not around necessarily to advocate for his own work at that time, I think some of his reputation is diminished that way. I also think the fact that he's working with figuration during the 20th century at a time when most people are looking at abstract painting, at conceptual art, at other types of art making, the work becomes less visible in that way.
Ian, you wrote a children's book about your father's early years called Grandpa and the Library, How Charles White Learned to Paint. How did Charles White learn to paint?
Well, his mother was a domestic, and when he was too old to go to work with her and accompany her, She had to leave him somewhere, and there were no daycare centers. She couldn't afford childcare. She was a single parent.
And this was in Chicago,
right?
This
was in Chicago. And so she would leave him at the Chicago Public Library, literally before he was five, and instruct the librarians that he would sit quietly in the corner. And he took it upon himself to draw illustrations from the books to learn how to read, which created problems for him as he became to maturate into a teenager, because he read about African-American history, African-American contributions, Crispus Attucks, and folks of that regard. And when he raised his hand in high school and suggested that these folks were contributors to this fabric of America, he was told basically to stifle himself, which unfortunately led to his truancy of those experiences. But put him back in the library. He wasn't just walking around. He kept educating himself, and that served him well.
He also, this is a story that's very emblematic of the time. He earned two scholarships. He won two scholarships, and then Esther, I'll let you tell the rest of the story.
Sure. So White was one of those kids, I think, who was just a naturally talented artist, and his mother was very, I think, intent on getting him the instruction he needed. He had some teachers at school who were interested in supporting him, and he did, in fact, win two scholarships to art schools in Chicago. And when he showed up to accept them and to enroll, all of a sudden it was discovered that there was an error, that he had not, in fact, received the scholarship. And, you know, even as a child, it was not lost on him that that was entirely because of his skin color. If he had been a little white child showing up to accept his scholarship, there would have been no issue. But he did end up then with a scholarship to the School of the Art Institute of Chicago, which was one of the few institutions at that time that did admit black artists. And so I think that ultimately served him well.
Did you know the story about your father?
Yes, I did. And subsequently, when he starts exhibiting in the South, he is not given access to the front door. And he actually has to view his work by entering the museum through the back door. And then even when he's viewing the work, people would come up to him and say, "This is amazing. Do you know who the artist is?" And just really bypass him as an individual.
And Esther, his works were part of the WPA, correct?
Yes, he begins working in Chicago as a professional artist under the auspices of the WPA.
Can you see how where he was living, what impact that had on his work?
I think so. I mean, the work he makes in Chicago is very reflective of the community he's in there, of various shared goals about the social issues there, very much reflected of that. He does spend a great deal of time in New York in the late 40s and the 50s. That's where he meets incredible other artists like Harry Belafonte, Sidney Poitier. He's part of a really active leftist community at that point. And so I definitely see you see that work reflecting, again, his community and those experiences in New York. And then when he moves to California, I think he's really a senior figure at that moment. And to me, I've always seen a little bit of an openness and more experimentation in those later works. I think he's at a place where he allowed himself to do that.
I want to bring in another voice into this conversation, Terrence McKnight, one of our hosts, one of my colleagues at WQXR. Now, Terrence, how did you get involved with this project? There's an audio component to this project.
I got a call from the curator, Esther, and she asked me to take a look at Charles's work and to respond to it musically. And that's what I've done.
When you first went through and you saw the different paintings and the different portraits, did you choose or did you work together which ones you were going to pick music for?
Well, I mean, there's so many. Yeah. And when I got the book and I started reading about his life, I was able to identify with it. Mm-hmm. You know, growing up in Cleveland and not really having a lot of school materials dealing with black folk, I understood where he was coming from. And so it was easy for me to look at the work and appreciate the work, appreciate the people that he brought forward in history. I mean, like his mom, my mother came from Mississippi, so there was that connection. Mm-hmm. We went to Cleveland, he went to Chicago.
Great
so
migration.
That's right. There was that connection. So I was able to easily identify with the characters, with the faces, with the images, and with his mission.
Let's talk about a couple. The painting Five Great American Negroes. Can you describe it for me, Terrence, and then what you saw and what you heard in your inner ear
Yeah, I mean, you see in that painting Booker T. Washington right at the front forefront of it. You see Marian Anderson in one corner, and you see a bunch of folks and a branch of a tree, and it seems to go way back. And I thought about those people, and I thought about if there was one message that they all had, you know, over 150 years of black folks being in this country. When Charles White came forward and he dropped out of school to really bring these images forward, he was saying, I'm black, I'm proud of being black, at a time where it was radical. And when James Brown said it in 1968, that was radical, to be proud of being something, being a color that just 100 years ago enslaved you. So that was powerful. And I thought that's the commonality between every figure in that image.
Let's hear a little bit of James Brown. I'll look for any opportunity to play James Brown. Esther, when was this painting painted, this Five Great American Negroes?
This is Charles White's first mural painting. So it's painted in 1939. It's now in the collection of the Howard University art collection, and it's on the wall of their law library, usually. So we were incredibly grateful to them for letting us borrow it to put it on the wall at MoMA.
All right. There's another J'accuse number 10, Negro Woman. What is this painting?
This painting, you see a group of women, all of color, I don't know, maybe 15 or 16 women with different expressions on their faces of different ages. And, you know, I thought it was important to have a song that embraced the universality of womanhood. You know, I was a kid, I heard this song by Helen Reddy, you know, and Charles White always talked to his students about bringing their own personal experience into their art. And I thought, I love this song as a kid. For some reason, I loved it. And I thought having Helen Reddy stand up for black women, for the universality of womanhood, and women standing up together was a powerful message at this time and around Charles's work.
Tell us a little bit about the painting.
Yeah, the painting is part of a series of works that White did called J'accuse. This particular painting actually ends up on the cover of Ebony in their Negro Woman edition. So it's an incredibly powerful, emblematic image that I think Terrence picked exactly the right music to emphasize.
Ian, would you tell me a little bit about your father as a teacher and a mentor? That was a big part of his life as well as being a painter.
Definitely. Following his time in New York, which are kind of his formative years, his years in California, he becomes that mentor. He ends up teaching some amazing artists that are contributors to contemporary art today. But he also instills this type of discipline that you don't customarily see. But it makes me think about, there was one morning we were gathering for breakfast, and there were some drummers outside. We live in the foothills of Altadena. And they're sitting out there playing bongos, and we're like, wow, this is really kind of unique. And they were basically serenading my father. And they came through reference to some friends from being students. So it was like, okay, there's something going on. Plus, you would always have students come by the house. So it was wonderful to see these folks as very young people, as a young person, and then see them as these mature contributing artists.
And before I let you all go, his most famous painting, probably one of his most famous, is Black Pope, Sandwich Board Man from 1973. Is that based on a real person?
The image is, I think, inspired by a photograph taken by the German photographer Leonard Fried of a street preacher in North Carolina. And White essentially takes this photo, so it's based on a real person, but transforms it entirely. I think the person that he makes the Black Pope into is not the original figure from the photograph. But for me, it's an amazing way to see how he transformed visual imagery to reflect his own ideas and different things going on in history and in culture at his time.
And Ian, we've been talking about him as a great painter and a great teacher. What do you remember about him as a dad?
Solid. Solid man. Raised the bar. Which is wonderful because I have this young son too. Oh. And all these, again, bringing him into the mix and being able to share with him this wonderful time at MoMA as well as the Art Institute, and subsequently in Los Angeles, is an amazing gift that the grandfather offers my young son.
Well, you can listen to Terrence's Choices. Terrence, host, McKnight host on WQXR. Esther Adler, curator for MoMA, and Ian White, the son of Charles White. Thank you all for coming on in. MoMA and the Art Institute of Chicago, they're presenting the first major museum retrospective of Charles White's work in more than 30 years. It opens this Sunday and runs through January 13th. I'm Allison Stewart. This is All of It. This is All of It. I'm Allison Stewart, and we're bringing you another conversation as part of our series, The All of It Guide to Your Holiday Week. A new exhibit opened in September at the Met, and it has attracted a lot of attention and surely an interesting visitor or two. It's called Everything is Connected, Art and Conspiracy. It's a 70-collection show about artists' interpretation of conspiracy and artists who perhaps believe they have uncovered conspiracy. We talked to Douglas Eklund this past fall. He is the curator of the Department of Photographs at the Met, and Ian Altavere, a curator in the Department of Modern and Contemporary Art at the Met. And also taking part in the conversation is Kathy Olmsted, professor of history at UC Davis and author of the 2009 book Real Enemies, Conspiracy Theories, and American Democracy, World War I to 9/11. I began by asking Doug Eklund what sparked the idea for this exhibit and how it was organized.
In 2010, seems like a long time ago, I was in touch with an artist and had just read the late artist Mike Kelly and had read an interview with him from 20 years before, from 1991, where he was saying, why hasn't anybody done a museum show about artists interested in conspiracy theory? And so I talked to him about that, and he's like, yeah, it was long overdue then and would be great to do now. So I was able to work with him on the checklist. His name is Mike Kelly. He was one of the most important contemporary artists of the last 50 years. Died in 2012, after a couple years after I had spoken to him. So this exhibition long predates our really cataclysmic moment where conspiracy theory has really enveloped the mainstream of culture. And back in 1991, conspiracy was really on the margin. So what I was interested in, and you know, the fact that we had conceived the show years before, meant that we could avoid the 2016 election and its aftermath. Yeah. And what we hope to do, which is what we do with all of our shows of contemporary art, is to historicize it and to give a sense that these issues, and Kathy can talk more about that, have always been with us. And it's really just a question of, you know, this artist that I spoke with, Mike Kelly, and I were sort of lamenting that in the counterculture days of the 60s and 70s, conspiracy was really just on the margins of this monoculture. Mm-hmm. And now with the internet, it's kind of become, it's like a banquet where it's just way too much and you don't want it in this sphere. And it's sort of too much. And so that's how the show came about. And the show is organized roughly chronologically, looking at these different historical moments, the 60s and the 70s, the 80s and the 90s. You think of the X-Files, when conspiracy sort of becomes a sort of ironic subject in and of itself, and then up to the present. So that's the layout.
Ian, I alluded to the fact that there's sort of two different kinds of art represented. Artists who are imagining conspiracy theories and artists who sort of participate in them. Can you explain that a little bit?
Sure, happily. Well, when Doug came to me shortly after Mike died and asked if I wanted to participate, to collaborate with him, I was thrilled because I had such an interest already in a group of artists that surrounded Mike in LA in the 1970s. But what I hadn't really thought about in this regard was their relationship to this kind of counterculture. So in the second half of the show, which is really where Mike Kelly and his contingent, Jim Shaw, Tony Orsler, Sue Williams, all friends from CalArts in the 70s, are kind of manifest in the show. They are the ones who, while they do deep research, kind of represent a more phantasmagoric side of conspiracy theories and the ways in which they are kind of trying to represent how things don't necessarily always seem to connect, and how could that possibly be? The first half of the show, by, in contrast, in a way, are artists who are deep, deep researchers who are really interested in the facts. So an artist like Mark Lombardi, with these amazing networks of names, some 560 names in the largest work of his in the show that we show, showing tracing money as it travels between past presidents, the Khashoggis, the Saudi royal family, and various offshore banks, or people such as Jenny Holzer or Trevor Paglen or Hans Hacke, who reveal in their work, you know, use government documents in their work, real facts. So the fact-based side of the show sets the stage, and then comes halfway through about the dive down the rabbit hole.
Down the rabbit hole. Did you find yourselves, Doug, going down the rabbit hole as you were curating this exhibit? And when did you know to stop? When did you say, hey, you know what? No.
I hesitate to quote Thomas Pynchon, who I sort of adhere to this, but I don't want to attract it, which is, he said, every weirdo in the world is on my wavelength. So I maintain a distance from 99.99% of it, but it's always been an interest. But yeah, the more that I got into each of the works, I mean, each work is kind of its own rabbit hole, and you've seen the show, so you know how dense and packed with information they are. So yeah, it was the progression of the show goes from Mark Lombardi, who's kind of the platonic ideal of just the facts, and the artists who deal with in the beginning of the show were very adamant about not having their works confused with the works in the second half of the show, which are really about sort of inhabiting the mind of someone who doesn't have all the facts and trying to figure out how these how what happens to them in life through this impossibly distant and complex governmental structure, how in the absence of those facts you get these fantasies. And so that was really, we always try to work off of the artists and how they are framing their work. And so the exhibition begins with this kind of forensic research, and slowly you move down the rabbit hole. And by the end, it's a very, it's disturbing. It's a very disturbing and weird kind of show, and people seem kind of shocked by it. But, you know, with this, what we were trying to do was really, this is about art that all the art in the show relates to movements like conceptual art or appropriation art, that kind of thing. But these artists want to inject these sometimes sort of formalist movements with real world content. So as a whole, the show is really about trying to tip the art toward a little more towards the real world. And I think that will result in a lot of people beyond just the art cognoscenti being really interested in this show.
I think a really great example of that is the piece that it looks like a Calder sculpture. Can you explain how that marries the artist's creativity with fact-based documents? Mm-hmm.
Sure, that's a great work from 2006 by the Venezuelan-born artist Alessandro Balteo Yazbek, who now lives and works in Berlin. And Alessandro was interested, on the one hand, in the legacy of modernist artists from the U.S., Calder in this case in particular, in the ways in which those works of art were used by the American government to promote so-called American ideals overseas. So the CIA, for example, was funding exhibitions of American modernism that traveled to Europe, that traveled to the Middle East and beyond in the 1950s in order to promote so-called democratic ideals. Calder himself was a professed left-wing person, and the idea that a kind of almost right-wing economic sensibility was using that work of art to promote its own kind of economic nationalism would have been disturbing to him, perhaps. But what happens in Alessandro's work is that there is a conjunction with that idea, that history, with the 2001 Cheney energy map of the Iraqi oil fields. And so in a way, the artist, the work itself, a kind of Calder-esque mobile stabile, casts a shadow that maps out the exact oil fields in that plan. And of course, we know what happens later on in the 2000s with regard to Iraq. And the connection then you know, 50 across 50 years between a certain U.S. economic policy in the 1950s and a certain U.S. policy in the 2000s comes kind of magically together and disturbingly together in Alessandro's work.
And you kind of let me take a picture of it. So it's on our All of It WNYC Instagram right now. So if you're listening to this right now, go to our Instagram and you can see what we're talking about. What are you going to dive into?
I was just going to say that there's a really great young art historian who saw that work and generated a series of articles about Calder and the way that his art was, unbeknownst to him, being sort of instrumentalized by these covert agencies. And so it's a work that takes a kind of what looks like, well, first of all, there's that idea of him imitating Calder, and some people may be put off to see this like pitch perfect imitation of a Calder that is not by him. But what he's really doing is sort of stepping into the role of how the government agencies invisibly were sort of authorizing or contributing to how the work was seen by having these shows around the Iron Curtain, or so he would get a commission for a hotel in Iran and have no idea that it was part of this plan of, you know, maybe let's say the Rockefellers to open up a new oil market. And so that piece in miniature really kind of shows like the fact and the research bit, but also this kind of like shocking speculative leap that he makes from Venezuela to Iran. And so that work in a nutshell captures like both the research, but also the inventiveness and the imagination of the artist.
Yeah, I think it's one of my favorites in the show. We're speaking with Douglas Eklund and Ian Altaver about the new show at the Met, Art and Conspiracy. I want to bring in Catherine Olmsted. You're a researcher, a historian. You've written this really interesting book called Real Enemies. And you make a point that conspiracy had been around in this country for a long time, but there really was a transformation in the 20th century. Tell us what led to the transformation and how it affects the way we think about conspiracy today.
Well, conspiracy theories have a long history in America. I mean, you could trace it back to the first English colonists coming to American shores. And there's a lot of conspiracy theories in America, particularly in the 19th century, among the native-born white Protestants who are suspicious of the Jews or the Catholics or sometimes the Masons or Wall Street conspiring against them. But what happens in the early 20th century, right around World War I, is that there's this pivotal moment when those conspiracy theories about religious minorities or ethnic minorities, they still exist. But more and more, Americans become suspicious of their own government and believe that their own government is conspiring against them. And this happens just at the moment when the U.S. government does get the power to conspire against them, when there are secret agencies created during World War I to spy on American citizens, to snuff out dissent. And of course, this just increases in the Cold War when you have the FBI taking on a lot of new roles with counter-subversion and also the creation of the CIA. So there are real government conspiracies that inspire conspiracy theories about the government.
And I think that's interesting because you folks shared with me that the government became interested in certain artists that appear in this show.
Yeah, now we're on the third rail.
Come a little closer to the third rail.
Doing this without a drink to loosen me up. There is Mark Lombardi, who had this amazing, he was kind of a demon researcher, someone called him. He was just like using hundreds of books and making index cards and making all these connections, including before 9/11 between the Bush family and the Bin Laden family. And after he died, which is he had just finished making the BCCI drawing about this bank scandal in the 1980s. He was just becoming a huge star, and he took his own life right after that. And in the first posthumous exhibition of his work at the Drawing Center, they were visited, the museum was visited by both FBI and Homeland Security, who were interested in Mark's research techniques. And they actually, I mean, we don't get into this in the show or the book because there's more than enough in the art to deal with. But if you do search Mark Lombardi on the internet, before you get to his art, you get to the conspiracy theories about what happened to him. And I steer clear of all of that.
Catherine, let me bring you back in here. What is going on now in our culture that allows conspiracy theories to bubble up and spread like they do, besides the internet? What's going on in terms of the American psyche right now?
Well, I think there's a lot of things going on. One, of course, is growing inequality. And so as there is more concentration of wealth and power at the top, it seems to a lot of people who are left out of that that there's a conspiracy going on. And so they're more inclined to look at conspiracies that explain that and everything else. And there's also, of course, plummeting distrust in the government, which has been a trend since the 1960s. And now it's only about, it's less than 20% of the American people who say they trust the government to do the right thing most of the time. And that's down from over two-thirds in the 1960s. So is that people just don't trust the government. And a relatively new trend is distrust in the media, which was trusted by most Americans, by majority, even as recently as about 15 years ago. And that has gone down, and the trust in the media. And so people don't feel like they don't know that they can trust the mainstream media. They don't know that they can trust what they read. And so there's this proliferation of, you know, alternative facts, as the president's people like to say, that people construct their own narratives. And we're no longer grounded in facts. You know, more transparency in theory can kill conspiracy theories, but unfortunately in our current political moment, there's so much distrust that it doesn't seem possible to do that.
Douglas Eklund and Ian Altaver from the Met, thank you so much. Art and Conspiracy, it's open now. And Catherine Olmsted, her book is called Real Enemies. Thank you so much to all of you for joining us on All of It.
Thanks for having us. Such a pleasure.
Since WNYC's first broadcast in 1924, we've been dedicated to creating the kind of content we know the world needs. In addition to this award-winning reporting, your sponsorship also supports inspiring storytelling and extraordinary music that is free and accessible to all. To get in touch and find out more, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.